Secretary of State Matt Dunlap on elections, licenses, and Maine's bicentennial. Maine's primary and special referendum election has been postponed until July 14th because of the coronavirus pandemic. Driver's license renewals and automobile registrations are all delayed too because the Bureau of Motor Vehicles is closed. And Maine's big bicentennial celebration did not take place on Maine Day because of social distancing concerns. But the work of the Secretary of State's office goes on. For example, Maine must decide whether to apply for special pandemic relief federal election funds. The census is underway. And tomorrow, Secretary Dunlap will determine the order of the bond questions on the July ballot. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Are you wondering about the safety, security, and fairness of upcoming elections? About the rollout of Real ID? Maine's Secretary of State joins us next on Maine Calling. But first, this news. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Earlier this month, Governor Janet Mills issued an executive order postponing the date of Maine's primary election from June 9th to July 14th. Today, we have the person responsible for making sure that election takes place fairly and securely. Matt Dunlap is serving his final term as the state's Secretary of State. He will talk to us today about the election and voting issues, as well as other matters his office oversees that have been affected by the pandemic. Secretary Dunlap, welcome back to Maine Calling.
It's always good to be on.
As always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about the upcoming elections or about other areas such as the Bureau of Motor Vehicles? Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Thank you for coming to your phone, Matt, on a state holiday, Patriots Day, to be with us. So many questions, that so many things that are affected by this pandemic that your office controls in Maine. And I want to start with the funding for elections. I understand that 37 states have applied for the special election funding related to the pandemic relief, $400 million. Is Maine one of them? Have we applied?
Not yet. We're working up a plan on how to spend it. You just can't ask for money. You have to have a plan on how you're going to utilize that. And one of the challenges we have is that we don't have an awful lot of extra things to pay for, oddly enough. You can only print so many ballots, and you can only lease so many tabulating machines. So we've been talking about some things that we could use the new federal money for, like if we have to go to a heavier absentee ballot turnout, for example, maybe we could help the towns with helping pay for postage, or towns have to, we had to change the date of the election. Towns sometimes have to rent space, or they have to find alternative space if their normal polling place is not available to them. Maybe we can help with that. So we're working on a list of things that we could make use of that new federal money and help promote the election and make it run a little bit smoother, not only for July, but also for November as well. Maine stands to get about $3.5 million. One of the things that's happening in Washington along the line of that $400 million is that there's actually a fairly substantial matching fund provision, which Congress is revisiting and talking about maybe eliminating the match simply because, you know, state budgets are kind of cratering right now with the losses in revenue. And also, like the case of Maine, our legislature is not even in town. So getting a $658,000 match to leverage the other $3.5 million would be a bit of a challenge for us. So they're still discussing that, and we're working on an application process now.
The primary election, as we just mentioned, has been moved from June 9th to July 14th. Other than a new date, will it be different in any other way?
Really, we're not planning on being much different right now. We had several weeks worth of discussions with the governor, and the governor was very concerned about maintaining the ability of the people to, as much as possible, every eligible citizen being able to participate in the election. So we talked about a couple of different vectors that we could see playing out. A lot of what's going to happen, we're not sure. We're not really sure where we're going to be with the pandemic, even as far out as July. One of the things that we had proposed as a safeguard was going to an all absentee format and not have polling places at all. The governor is a bit concerned about that, and I know we've also heard from some of the folks in the disability community and some of the elections advocates about, you know, not being able to access the accessible voting solution, you know, that's in place for people with disabilities to vote as much as possible without assistance from someone else. And it's a particular voting machine that we have in every polling station. So there's a lot of concern about not having that available. There are other factors yet unknown. Are towns going to be able to have polling stations? Are they going to be able to staff them? That was a huge concern of ours. So there are a couple of things that could yet happen that the governor is keeping in her back pocket. But for now, it looks like the only thing that's really changing is the date. And we encourage the governor to push it out beyond the 4th of July holiday, because it is going to be a ranked choice election. So if we have to gather materials and start doing tabulations, that we won't stumble over a holiday for that. And it'll also afford enough time for the parties to deal with any candidate withdrawals after the primary and replacements, any recounts we might have, so that we can start putting together a ballot for the fall election on November 3rd.
You say it will be a ranked choice election. Run us through a typical ballot in somebody's typical town. If they're voting, for example, in the Democratic primary for U.S. Senate, that will be a ranked choice vote?
Yeah, all county, state, and federal races, county races will not be ranked choice, but all state and federal elections for the nominations for the November general election will be conducted by ranked choice. And that's going to be a sort of a grid-style ballot. Like right now, for example, we have three candidates in the Democratic primary. We also have, I think, at least three candidates, maybe four candidates for the Republican nomination for the second CD. So those will be set up as grids, and people can mark their choices in order. And we have a whole process developed and ruled that has played out through our experience with how voters behave with ballots. And it played out really, really well when we used ranked choice voting for the first time just a couple of years ago. So we don't anticipate seeing that change a lot. But you'll have the ranked choice races on one side of the ballot and then the non-ranked choice on the other side. And then, of course, every voter will have the bond questions available. We have two bond questions as well that'll be on the ballot in July.
And I understand you're determining the order of those bond questions tomorrow?
As a matter of fact, we are. We're going to do a drawing for the ballot order, even though there's two questions. One will be question one, and one will be question two. So it's actually something that people really care about. So we try to make something of a ceremony out of it. And we'll do a drawing to see whether the transportation bond, which is a $105 million bond for highway improvement, and which will actually leverage another $275 million in federal funds, and then also the internet infrastructure bond, which is $15 million that'll leverage another $30 million in federal and private funds. So one will be question one, the other will be question two, and we'll do that tomorrow afternoon, or tomorrow morning, rather.
If these bonds pass, will the delay in the vote affect the projects the bonds pay for? Because the vote will be happening 5 weeks later than it would have.
Well, if it does delay, it'll be a minor delay, because even though, you know, the election's on July 14th, assuming they both get approved, the money would not be available on July 15th, because we would have to take 20 days to certify the election. The governor has 10 days to sign the certification, and then they would go into effect 30 days after that. So it would be the end of August anyway before you'd see much happening with that. And I think certainly the folks that do the type of planning that is needed to be done for these types of infrastructure projects, if the bonds are approved, they can go ahead and begin their process of planning and encumbering contracts and that sort of thing. So they don't have to wait till the money is available before they start that work. But it does take a while to shake it loose.
Let's talk about the latest effort to overturn Maine's ranked choice voting law. If opponents collect enough signatures for a people's veto, what will that mean for the November ballot? Will it be a ranked choice ballot?
If they gather enough signatures to overturn the law that was passed by the legislature, then what would be affected would be the race for president. The other races that would use ranked choice voting would be the U.S. Senate race and the congressional race, the federal races only. Those would still continue to be conducted by ranked choice. So it's only the presidential race that's affected by the ranked choice people's veto. So should they submit 63,067 signatures by 90 days after the adjournment of the legislature, and the legislature adjourned on March 17th, so you can kind of do the math there, it's about the middle of June, and we have 30 days to certify that from when that's turned in. So we'll be finishing up the certification of the ranked choice people's veto about the same time that we're going to be running the president's July 14th primary. We will know well in advance as to whether or not we'll be using ranked choice voting for the presidential election.
Clean Election candidates, as you know, have argued that it's going to be difficult for them to get the signatures they need because of social distancing, that they can't go door to door, can't set up a table at the local hardware store. Some other states have changed their rules to help independent or, non-party candidates qualify for the ballot. Any discussion of that in Maine?
Yeah, we've done the same thing in Maine. So non-party candidates who are not part of the primary nomination, they get their signatures. They have to get so it's a slightly different set of rules. And let me just back up real quick. I just want to clarify something I said about the people's veto. Getting the signatures, and we certify the signatures, would put a stay on the effectiveness of the law. That's why you would not see it in November. You'd vote on it in November, but we would not be using ranked choice voting for the presidential election because of the stay affected by the signatures being certified. So I just want to clarify that, why we would not see it just because they turn in their signatures. You still have to vote on it. But getting back to the independents, independent candidates, they get a little bit more time to gather their signatures. Now, party candidates had to have their petitions in by March 16th. That deadline's already passed. It's not been changed, but non-party candidates would have to get their signatures turned in to the Secretary of State's office by June 1st under normal circumstances. And because of the pandemic, the governor in her executive order has extended that deadline to July 1st. So they get an extra month to gather signatures. Now they have to get twice as many. So if you're an independent candidate for the Maine House of Representatives, you have to get 50 signatures, 200 for state Senate, 2,000 for Congress, and 4,000 for U.S. Senate. Those candidates who are out circulating petitions now have a little bit more time to do it. In terms of public financing for state candidates for the legislature, their deadline has also been pushed out into May instead of April. So they have a little bit more time as well, because it is hard to go door to door or make arrangements to have people sign forms and submit checks for the public financing match. It's a big undertaking, and I know that a lot of candidates who started that process early are kind of reaping the benefits now because they've got those questions answered for themselves.
All right. We're speaking with Secretary of State Matt Dunlap about all sorts of things, including elections, and we're going to get to the Bureau of Motor Vehicles soon and Maine's Bicentennial. If you have a question for him, 1-800-399-3566. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. Matt, in addition to the presidential race, Congress, state legislature, and local races, we know that we will be voting in November on the New England Clean Energy Connect. You recently ruled on those petitions. Tell me what your office found. What was the controversy and what was the decision?
Well, the initial initiative was a resolve that directs the Public Utilities Commission to make certain findings about the New England Clean Energy Connect. And they turned in their signatures. They turned in about 75,000 signatures, not all of which were verified when they were brought to us because some of the towns had found duplicates and such. We went through a 30-day review under the Constitution. We found they had about 69,000 signatures, so we said it was good. Opponents to the initiative effort went to court, and they asked the court to remand the whole thing back to us and do a little bit of a deeper dive on some allegations of improper conduct by some notaries and some circulators and additional duplicates. We did that in an expedited way. We did find that there's a couple notaries. Now, the notary public role here is very, very explicit and quite narrow. So a notary public under the law, if they're employed to notarize the circulator's oath on a petition form, cannot have any other vested interest in the campaign. They can't be a planner for the campaign. They can't be a field coordinator. They can't have a vested interest. So there were a couple who, upon making a few phone calls, said, oh, yeah, I also circulated petitions. I bought coffee for the office, et cetera. So we were able to disqualify the petitions that they notarized or circulated because of that conflict. Others, it was much more nebulous, and as you know, like maybe dropping something off at the town office after they notarized it. And we didn't really think that that rose to the threshold of disqualification. The court agreed with us in their finding. So now, because of that, it is duly qualified and will be on the ballot for November. I'm sure there's going to be more litigation about this, which I can't speak to, but that's where it is today.
Tell me what the question would do. Would it be binding?
It's hard to say because I'm not an attorney. So, they would direct. It's unusual, and I think this may be subject to further court action as to whether or not you can take a regulatory authority and instruct it to do something that it ordinarily would vote on. It'd be like telling the town council that they have to approve parking meters, or not approve parking meters. And it's not been tested, I don't think, in the law. So I think the effect of it would be binding, yes, but whether or not it probably would not be the last word. I think it'd be safe to say, should the voters adopt it, I'm sure there'll be more discussion in the judicial branch about the effectiveness of it.
Let's talk about the Bureau of Motor Vehicles. It's been closed since March 17th. What does that mean for driver's license, automobile registrations, et cetera?
It sort of speaks to how fast all this has happened. We shut down the Bureau of Motor Vehicles, and we did so because there was a scare. We had an employee who had a family member that was quite sick, and the doctor was treating that family member as a presumed positive. And I got word of that as I was pulling in the driveway at work. And, we had a quick consultation with CDC and the governor's office, and our immediate response within 10 minutes was send everybody home. And it turned out it was a smart thing to do. And luckily, the person that was sick was did not test positive. They were cleared of COVID-19. And at this point, we don't know of any of our staff that have been confronted with the virus. So that's good. It does have a downside in which the mail keeps coming in and the work keeps piling up. And the immediate action we took with the governor was to extend the expiration dates on all expiring registrations and licenses for 30 days beyond the expiration of the civil emergency, which right now is May 15th. So if things start getting under control by then by June 15th, people would have until that amount of time to get those renewals taken care of. We have had a skeleton crew going in. When I say skeleton crew, we're talking 20 to 30 people in the main office, which is a building that normally houses almost 300 people. And they've been knocking down some of the backlogs and triaging work and getting it ready for the folks, like say in the titles division, to come in and bang out some title applications into actual physical titles, vehicle titles. It's a huge operation. And, we generate, I don't even know how much work. I mean, we register 1.5 million vehicles every year. We license 1 million drivers. We have 12,000 new drivers a year. And all those vehicles and all those drivers have licenses and permits. And we have, with the commercial trucking industry, we've been working with them on getting some of their permits for like going into Canada and interstate trucking. And we've even taken on the problem of private sales. Somebody buys a vehicle from a neighbor or a friend, and there's no way to register it. We've actually got a letter that people can print off saying, I purchased this vehicle in a private sale, and I can't complete the registration. In some cases, because they can't even pay their excise tax at their town hall. So we've been learning a lot of ways of doing workarounds for the last month or so. And it's gotten into a bit of a rhythm, but we'll be glad when everybody gets back.
All right. Well, we are speaking with Secretary of State Matt Dunlap. Have to take a break. So many more questions for you, Matt. Stay with us.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Fogtown Brewing Company, offering beer to go from their curbside corner store and deliveries within a 20-mile radius of Ellsworth. Fogtownbrewing.com.
COVID-19 has changed daily life in the United States, and with news breaking by the hour, it can be hard to stay up to date. I'm Michelle Martin. Join us every weekday for a new live conversation about the disease, what you need to know, what's coming next, and we will answer your questions. The National Conversation with All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's coming up this evening at 9 o'clock right here on Maine Public Radio. The news these days is fast and furious and intense, and you know that listeners are listening intently to Maine Public Radio. They depend on it, and more listeners have been listening over the last few years. Many business owners or organization leaders choose to support Maine Public Radio. They believe in the value of the service, know that it is very important to listeners, and a good way to reach listeners like you. If your business or organization is interested in knowing more, please visit mainpublic.org and click on Support and then Business Support. Or call Susan Tran at 800-884-1717. And thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Maine Secretary of State Matthew Dunlap is our guest. We're talking about matters his office oversees, including the upcoming elections. We invite you to be part of the conversation. You could send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. And we will start with a call. This is Bob calling from Portland. Hi, Bob. Go ahead. Bob, are you there?
Hi.
Bob. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Thanks, Secretary Dunlap. It's Bob Mensinger. I'm on the ballot for the June 14th election in the Portland area. And as the first election out of the chute, we're kind of very on edge, as all candidates are right now, about making sure voters' voices are heard on July 14th. And so earlier I heard the good news that only the date would be changed. However, you know, I guess my first question is, do you feel like changing only the date will preserve the vote and a robust vote on July 14th? And then second question is, has the Secretary of State's office given any thought at all to the possibility of going to a vote-by-mail system that the state of Oregon has done since about 1998, and which actually, as you know, veterans and overseas Americans have been able to do since about 1864? And I threw that in there because I know you're a history buff, Matt. And, you know, during the Civil War, there were somehow 150,000 Union soldiers who were able to vote by mail. So, given a wartime footing for the July 14th primary, Secretary, could you please outline for candidates and voters on how, including vote by mail, we could make sure as many people who want to vote can? Thanks very much.
Well, thanks, Bob. And you're right. We take a fair amount of inspiration from the election of 1864. We tell people that if it was possible to conduct an election nationally in the height of the Civil War, that we shouldn't feel like anything can hold us back on the election. So vote by mail is something that's been talked about a lot. And I think it's important to say that, you know, absentee balloting is a little bit different than vote by mail. And it sounds like it's a distinction without a difference, but they're very, very different mechanisms. We went out to Oregon many years ago when I was in office the first time and checked out how Oregon does it. I was actually there for a conference, and I kind of scratched my head why the United States Postal Service was the prime sponsor of the conference until I figured it out that they do all vote by mail there. And it's a very, very robust system where it is engineered around the different mechanisms that Oregon law embraces that we don't have. For instance, they have a registration deadline. We have election day registration. And also they have open primaries where ours are closed. So, you know, everybody gets the same ballot. So that's a bit of a hurdle for us. We have talked about doing something along the line of all absentee if necessary. And I know for the aforementioned reasons around people being able to vote who have disabilities, maybe visual disabilities, dexterity disabilities, Oregon also offers a model for that as well, because they do have polling stations. People can go to a town hall and use an accessible voting solution who cannot manage a paper ballot, for example. But they also have tremendous cooperation from the Postal Service. They have drop boxes put around in different locations for people to submit their ballots. They're considered as cast if they get them there by 8 o'clock on election night. And so there's a lot of infrastructure. So we have talked about vote by mail. We talked about it with the legislature. At the time, the legislature was cool to the idea because we have such a robust and open mechanism for using absentee ballots. So going forward, we want to make sure that every qualified citizen can, in fact, cast a ballot this July primary. I keep saying June, this July primary. And we've told the governor that, you know, we want to make sure there's plenty of time for that. So you can't wait till a week before when we're still at a stay-at-home order, and hopefully we're not in that posture in July, to then go to all absentee. You'd want to have about a 30-day notice anyway. And because there was some more time to work with and the governor didn't feel great about doing that anyway, they've decided to leave it basically the same format that we've always used, which is in-person voting, with the presumption that if we have difficulty getting polling stations, poll workers, or there's still a health issue out there, that we have the all absentee ballot. And under all absentee, we would not automatically send everybody a ballot. People would still have to ask for it. And that's an important component in the chain of custody, that you want to make sure that real voters are getting the real ballot and that they're the voters who are asking for them, so that you know exactly who has ballots and who has access to them and who's returning them. We've made that process as simple as we can. It's not electronic, unfortunately, for folks, but we've done just about everything we can to expedite the requesting process for absentee ballots and voter registration as well.
Bob, thanks for your question. A related question. This is a tweet from John. With most town offices closed to the public, how do I get my mail-in ballot for the July and November elections?
Well, one of the things that was in the executive order, and this is for people who have not yet requested, they can request now. We're within 90 days. So, the law says you can't request a ballot more than 90 days, which would leave stranded people who had already filed their requests. Part of the executive order honors those requests. So if you've already asked for one, you will get it. We have an absentee ballot request service on our website. You can call your town office. You can send them an email. And of course, you can download the paper application and mail it to the town office. While most town offices are closed, or many of them, they still have people working there. They just may be closed to public traffic. So I would not write off that mechanism of getting an absentee ballot by contacting your town office. If you have a problem, you should call our offices, and we'll see what we can do to expedite a ballot for folks.
All right. We have a few questions related to the Bureau of Motor Vehicles. I'll start with an email from Parker. My son just turned 15, and I want for him to get his learner's permit. How can this happen now with all the COVID-19 restrictions?
Getting a learner's permit right now is wicked hard, mostly because not only are we closed, but also most of the driver ed schools are closed for obvious reasons. So if somebody's been through driver education and they have the certificate that they got from driver education, they still have to take a written test with us. And right now, while our offices are closed, they're not going to be able to do that. So, you know, we don't really have an answer for that particular circumstance right now. With any luck here, in the next few weeks or a couple of months, we'll have the offices open again and we can start resuming those services. But we're not doing any testing. We're not doing any road tests. We're not doing any written exams, simply because there's no way to do that without exposing people to a violation of the distancing rules. So to keep our own staff and the public safe, we're basically, our offices are closed until further notice. And when we open them up again, we can resume that type of testing.
An email from Maddie. I'm a 16-year-old from the Maine School of Science and Math who is planning on getting my license when I return from school in the spring. My concern is that there will be a massive backup when the DMV opens, and that I may not be able to get my license before I leave to go back to school in August. There is no way to contact DMV right now. So my question is there some sort of wait list I can put my name on for getting my license?
Well, there's no wait list right now, but you can call us. And, you know, a lot of what we do, even in non-COVID-19 times, is we try to help people in special circumstances where people are traveling or they're going to be out of town. We can expedite tests. You know, I've administered a lot of Class C tests myself. One time we had an examiner who had a car crash, got hurt, and it was a slow day in the office. It was out of the Augusta branch, and I just went over the branch, and I took the fellow's clipboard, and I did tests for the afternoon, which is a bit of a shock to the students to have the Secretary of State getting in the car with them. I can't do CDL exams because I'm not federally certified, and I choose not to do motorcycle tests. So, but, you know, we can find a way to help somebody out. There is no wait list right now, and it is going to be a bit of a tidal wave for sure. But we're going to do our very best to get those backlogs cleared out as fast as we can and help people like Maddie.
Once the lockdown, this is from Paul, an email. Once the lockdown is over, there will be an overload on the local DMV. What about setting up a system for making an appointment with the local DMV to reduce the anticipated wait times? It might be a good system anyway, because wait times have been increasing.
The wait times that we experienced last year were mostly because we were shorthanded. Luckily, we've been able to get a lot of people hired up in the interim, and our wait times have dropped off. We were also looking at an appointment system prior to the decision to close, that maybe we'd have people come in by appointments only, and we were pushing people who had routine business, like just a simple renewal, pushing people towards our online services. And those are still available for folks. They should check them out before they think they can't be helped, because we can do that. It's a good idea. We will have an awful lot of people waiting for service. And that's one of the reasons why we've been trying to work at some of the backlogs on a lot of the paperwork, because we deal with a lot of stuff that's just plain paper. And that's something that we've been trying to knock down so that the lines won't be as bad when we do come back. And going forward, we may even talk to the governor about pushing out more than 30 days, honoring expired credentials if it looks like we're not going to be able to serve everybody in a timely way.
We've got a Skip who's calling from Stonington. Hi, Skip. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer and Matt. Thank you very much. Matt, I know that we have in national and statewide elections a high percentage of people who vote in Maine, not so much in primary elections. Wouldn't this be a perfect opportunity to try and have voting on a Saturday or Sunday to see if we get more people to vote?
Well, you know, we've talked about turnout in primaries. You're right. Part of the reason why our turnout is a bit lower in primaries, as I mentioned before, we have closed primaries. So if, you know, you have a situation where your party doesn't have any contested races, there's not a lot of reason for you to go vote. There's also a blackout period where you can't change parties. If you're a Republican, you can't enroll in the Democratic Party less than 15 days before the primary. So the end of June is the deadline for that. Of course, there's something there for everybody. There is the bond ballot. And you're right. In the general election, our turnout could exceed 70 to 73%. But in the primary, it could be as low as 10 or 15%, maybe around 20 to 25 if you have a hot contested race in a primary. Voting on Fridays or Saturdays, one of the things that we experimented with a couple of years ago was early voting, where you'd have a polling station set up in a town office and people could go in during regular business hours and they could request a ballot, they could mark it, and they could cast it. Everybody loved it. The town clerks loved it. The voters loved it. The problem that we have is that certainly in the general election, the election is described as being the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November. That is it, no more. So we couldn't do early voting for candidate elections in November. The primary gives us a little bit more flexibility, to be sure. But right now, with so much else going on, adding in new things adds a degree of difficulty that might be lethal. So we're not going to do anything that we have not done before for this coming primary election in the face of the pandemic. So understanding that, we'll probably just run the election the way we have for now, understanding it'll probably be lower turnout, but we'll make it as available as we can.
Skip, thanks so much for your question. We're going to take another quick break, speaking with Secretary of State Matt Dunlap on Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling, with help from the University of Maine at Augusta, committed to providing a quality, affordable education online and in the classroom. UMA.edu. Pharma, America's biopharmaceutical companies, committed to beating the coronavirus. Updates from these companies are available at pharma.org/coronavirus. And Dead River Company, committed to keeping Maine's homes and businesses warm and proud to be part of celebrating Maine's bicentennial. DeadRiver.com.
On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
The Maine Teachers Association led a protest march on April 20, 1982, from the Ramada Inn in Bangor, where they held their state assembly, to the University of Maine at Bangor Chancellor's Office to protest stalled contract negotiations with 500 University of Maine professional workers. The Maine Teachers Association's president, Beth Supernovich, led the march. This march followed 1,200 students protesting the low wages of the faculty at the University of Maine at Orono in September of 1981.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Thomaston Place Auction Galleries and Maine Maritime Museum. Happy birthday, Maine!
The daily Maine CDC briefing on the coronavirus takes place about 2 o'clock each weekday afternoon. Maine Public Radio, Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page will bring it all to you live. In addition, each day's address is archived at MainePublic.org for later on-demand viewing or listening. Just choose the television drop-down. Again, that's Maine's CDC briefing with Dr. Shah and others, coming up in just a few minutes, 2 o'clock this afternoon, and carried here on Maine Public Radio, as well as Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on our program, Maine Secretary of State Matthew Dunlap is my guest, and we are talking about all sorts of things, including elections, voting, real ID, and more. Speaking of, before we go back to calls, I want to ask you about real ID, Matt. I understand that the deadline for, I don't know if it's called a deadline, or the date for which one has to have a real ID for certain kinds of travel and certain kinds of access has been postponed. It was going to be October 1st. Do we know when the new deadline is?
Well, it's October 1st, 2021, and I laugh about this because when Real ID was passed, it was anticipated that it would be fully effective by May of 2008, which was 12 years ago, and we've been pushing off deadlines for quite a while. Part of that is because it has a lot of technical requirements, which, and also some philosophical issues around privacy that have alarmed legislatures around the country. Maine was the first one to opt out of Real ID initially, and then later reverse course and embrace it simply because the penalties on the public were going to be so extravagant that no one felt it was worthwhile making everybody get a passport, for example. So we implemented Real ID last year. If people are, when our offices are open, they can come in and obtain a Real ID if they don't have a passport. About half of our citizens, believe it or not, have passports because we're on a border state. Compliance with Real ID has been hovering between 20 and 25% nationally because of those reasons. So the deadline has been pushed off another year. It was supposed to be this coming October 1st. It'll be now 2021. One thing I would make a plug for outside of Real ID, because I am the chair of the state's United States Census Complete Count Committee, people are making me look wicked bad. Maine is last in the country in responding to the census. And where we've been pushing online services so much, I can't let this opportunity go without making a plug for people to get into the census, get their households factored in. And all you have to do is go online and go to 2020census.gov. It'll take you 5 minutes to complete the census form. It's wicked important. for allocating things like election funds, transportation funds, apportioning congressional districts, you name it. So I'd like to remind people that we're in the census period now.
All right. Another topic, Maine's bicentennial celebration. I know there are a lot of things going on, but the big party was supposed to be March 20th in Augusta. Is there going to be a different party, Matt?
Well, we may have a party at some point. Everything around the bicentennial has just been thrown off the rails because of the timing of the shutdown and the stay-at-home order. I know the folks in the Bicentennial Commission, I'm on the Bicentennial Commission, the staff is housed in our offices. It was heartbreaking for them, really. I mean, they spent years planning this and got sponsorships all lined up. It was supposed to be quite a kickoff with, you know, the Bangor Symphony was going to be there. And you know, we've been planning for the tall ships coming to Maine. And it's all been kind of thrown into the woods because of the pandemic. They are still planning on having plenty of events, probably a kickoff at some point. Going to have a parade in August with a State of Maine marching band that my daughter has signed up for, so you can watch her in action. So there's still a lot going on with the bicentennial, and public Maine public has done a great job with their daily vignettes of the bicentennial, things that happened in Maine history, which remind, I think, everybody of how important Maine is in the context of telling American history and our status in the world as a whole. So it's been really, really great to be a part of, regardless of the fact that we haven't been able to have a lot of the events that we planned.
One more question I haven't been able to ask you yet, Matt, before we return to callers and emailers, and there are a lot of them. The July and November elections, what kind of security issues are you preparing for? What are you hearing? Are you hearing warnings from the NSA and FBI this time around?
It's interesting because about 2 months before the pandemic really hit Maine, the discussion on everybody's lips was around cybersecurity. Now, because we're a paper ballot state, you know, the cybersecurity issues aren't as pronounced as they are in those jurisdictions that use voting machines, for example, and fewer jurisdictions use voting machines. I believe Pennsylvania this year is going to all paper ballots for the first time in quite a few years, and major change for them. So with the pandemic, of course, the discussion has been about mitigating a public health crisis. But we have not. We're on a daily alert with the Department of Homeland Security and some of their information sharing and analysis centers that they put out alerts for us. We feel very strongly that our election is secure because we are using paper and pen. Yes, we have a voter registration system that is on the internet, but if that was totally destroyed, shut down, locked up, we could still have an election. People might have to fill out a voter registration card again, but because we have Election Day registration, it's a tool that serves not only as a convenience, but also as a safeguard to the election itself.
All right. Well, we have about 10 minutes left. I'm going to see how many questions we can get through in that time. We'll go to Alan, who's calling. Alan is going from Scarborough. Hi, Alan. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
Okay, I just turned 69 this month, and just coincidentally, that was the same date that my driver's license expired. So technically, I've been driving around with a license that's not legal anymore, and can't go to the DMV because I would have to, I need to get the eye exam, and of course, I can't stay closed. So my question is, if, say, hypothetically, I had a busted taillight, and a policeman pulled me over, you know, and asked to see my license, I'd like to know what kind of reaction am I going to get. Am I going to get a ticket? Is it just going to be waved away? You know, what kind of response am I going to get with a technically illegal license?
I think Matt has some good news for you. Secretary of State?
Yes, Alan. Absolutely, Alan. Unless your license is suspended, you're fine. Part of the governor's executive action that she took early on was to extend the life of expiring credentials for another 30 days beyond the expiration of this civil emergency, which she's already extended that. So at a bare minimum, your license will be honored through the middle of June. So you should have plenty of time to get your eye test done and get that taken care of for us.
All right. Good luck, Alan. We'll go to Marty calling from Fort Fairfield. Hi, Marty. Go ahead. Mary from Fort Fairfield.
Hi. I have two cars, one of which is in the shop right now. The other one we haven't registered it since 2018, and right now we can't register it at all. But someone told me it was all right to drive it if we had our insurance card with us. Is that all right? Is that true?
Well, it's kind of true. I mean, if you have not registered a vehicle, again, that order was to cover expiring registrations. If your registration's already been expired for a couple of years, it doesn't help you. So having an insurance card won't cover as registration. So right now, we don't really have a mechanism to let that go forward. If you buy a car and can't register to pay the excise tax, and we can provide you with a letter that's saying that you're just hamstrung right now. You can't get to the town office, pay excise tax. Chances are, Mary, you're probably going to be okay anyway, because in such a strange time with so many services unavailable, including at the town level. I mean, if your town office is closed, you can't pay your excise tax. So you're probably okay in any case, but it's not a registered vehicle, the same as if you had bought it from a neighbor and couldn't register it. So I think that law enforcement's treating those pretty much the same. But for our purposes, we would only consider it extended if it had expired sometime before the middle of March.
Mary, thanks for your call. We're going to go to Joanne, who's calling from Cape Elizabeth. Hi, Joanne. Go ahead.
Hi there. I think you just answered a bit of my question, but we purchased a vehicle through a private sale, and my question about registering it, he mentioned a little bit about getting the letter that says that. But so would that mean getting it road ready? What about license plates? How do you go about getting a private sale vehicle on the road during these times?
Well, we don't anticipate that you're able to, unless you can get to it. Unless your town office does new registrations and is open, then there's really no way to do that. So you'd print the letter off of our website and just keep it in the car with you. And if law enforcement pulls you over because you don't have any plates, show them the letter and they'll acknowledge that. So it's the same situation. We can't demand services from people who can't obtain them. So you're probably all set in that case.
All right, Joanne, good luck. An email from Anne. I don't have a computer. I usually use the one at the library and can't do that anymore. How can I get a census form to fill out and send in? I can't get an answer to that.
That's a very good question. And that's if you don't have access to a computer and you can't get a census form, what I'd advise Ann to do is to give us a call at 626-8400 tomorrow, and we'll make sure that she gets the right form. We'll mail it to her.
All right. A tweet from Martin, which I think I know the answer to. When will the broadband bond be voted on? And that's July 14th, right?
That is July 14th. That's absolutely right. That will be the primary and bond election.
All right. An email from Karen. Has the deadline for seed money donations to clean election candidates also been extended to May 19th?
I believe it has. So everything from clean elections was pushed out a month.
All right. We have an email from Tiffany Bond, who's an independent candidate. We'll go to one of her three questions because we're running out of time. But she asks, how can independents safely and ethically collect, notarize, certify, and submit their signatures?
Well, the petitions for independents have also been extended for a month. So they were normally due June 1st, but those are now set to be submitted to our offices on July 1st. So they'll have some extra time to make those arrangements and get those signatures for the November ballot.
An email from Mary. I'd encourage Secretary Dunlap to use some of the additional federal funding to expand the number of polling places. I'm familiar with the situation in Lewiston, where multiple neighborhood polling places have been consolidated to only three for the entire city. This has created a big barrier for citizens who can't drive. I know this has happened elsewhere in Maine. If finding poll workers is the problem, fix that rather than making voting harder.
Well, I can't say I disagree with her. I mean, but that's been the challenge, is getting people to work at the polls. And a lot of the poll workers that we use are usually older people, retirees, and they're actually in a very vulnerable group. So I know that a lot of the town clerks have been writing to us expressing their concerns about being able to obtain polling place workers for the election that we have. Maybe we could utilize some of the federal money and pay folks, but that'd be a one-time thing, and it probably wouldn't be until November because we're short on time now for the July primary. I keep doing that. I'm sorry.
An email from Pat. I know you cannot mail voters a ballot, but can you mail them all an absentee ballot request form?
We could do that, and we've talked about having that available because the absentee ballot request form is already online, you don't even need the form to request the absentee ballot. We could send them one. It would be something that we could use some of the federal money for. It would probably cost us about $250,000 to do that, utilizing some of the mechanisms that the Postal Service has available. They have the Every Door Direct program, which we could use for something like this. But again, we certainly would want people to ask for their ballots just so that we know that they're getting to the voters who request them.
An email from Gregory. How about open primaries to foster less contention in politics?
That's a policy decision of the legislature. And one of the challenges with legislators rewriting election laws is you have to bear in mind that they got elected in the system that's in place right now, and it worked pretty well for them. So open primaries have been discussed a lot over the years. It hasn't quite gained the traction it needs to pass in the legislature.
All right, Matt, you've got about 30 to 45 seconds. What are your final words of wisdom as we think about this being an election year during a pandemic?
Well, this has been really strange for everybody. And what I've emphasized to our folks and to the public is that we are doing the best we can. There's no playbook for any of this. We haven't seen a pandemic of this scale in over 100 years. And the good news is that we know what it is we're dealing with. It's not a mystery. When the flu pandemic hit in 1918, it got on top of government services before anybody knew what was going on. At least we're in front of this. The indications are that the advice that Dr. Shaw is giving us seems to be working, and hopefully we'll be back to normal sooner rather than later. My job is to make sure that everyone who wants to obtain these services and vote in our elections is able to do so, and we're committed to that.
Well, Secretary Dunlap, thanks so much for joining us today on Patriots Day. Matthew Dunlap, Maine's Secretary of State, serving his final term in that position. In just a few minutes here on Maine Public Radio, CDC Director Dr. Nirav Shah will be giving his daily press briefing. You can also watch the briefing on Maine Public Television or on our website. Nikki Shields ran the board today. This show will be rebroadcast at 7 this evening. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.